1744 CR State v. Jordan A. Dank. Arguing on behalf of the defendant, Mr. Dank, is Laura Cerrone. And then we will have Michael Lossie of the Attorney General's Office arguing for the state of Wisconsin. You may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Laura Cerrone, and I represent Jordan Dank.
Excuse me, could you move the microphone down just a little bit?
Is that better?
Oh, yeah, it's a lot better.
Thank you. I'm short, too.
All right. Thank you.
Much better.
In the Court of Appeals, two issues were raised. One was a Fourth Amendment search and seizure issue, and the other was a plea withdrawal issue. I am going to focus today on the suppression issue, mainly, though, of course, I'm ready to answer any questions on the plea withdrawal issue.
I'm still having a little trouble hearing you, so belt it out.
Okay.
Pull it over towards you. There you go.
What I intend to do is briefly summarize the facts of the case and then present my argument. My argument is basically broken down into two parts. One is that the facts of this case do not fit into any of the exceptions to the warrant requirement. And the second part of that is that I just want to point out and make clear that that will not, given the unique facts of this case, that will not in any way tie the hands of police officers or change their practice or take away any authority that they already have. There are plenty of other investigative measures that officers can take. One November evening, an officer saw a vehicle stopped at the side of the road. After approaching the car and making sure that everything was all right, the officer ran the license plates and discovered that they were registered to a different vehicle. When the officer reapproached the driver's side of the car, he smelled the odor of marijuana. There were two people in the car, the driver, Mr. Pickering, and a passenger, my client, Jordan Dank. The officer asked Pickering for consent to search the car, and Pickering agreed. The officer then ordered Pickering and Dank out of the car. The officer told Pickering to empty out the front pocket of his sweatshirt and to place the contents on the car itself. As Pickering was emptying his pockets, the officer noticed what he believed to be a glass smoking pipe or drug paraphernalia inside of the pocket. There was some more discussion, and eventually, it's not clear from the record whether the officer retrieved it from Mr. Pickering's pocket or whether he had Pickering remove it, but that's not important from my perspective. At any rate, the item of paraphernalia was found, and then there was a search done. After that, there was probable cause to search Mr. Pickering. The officer searched Mr. Pickering and found more things, more items, more contraband, marijuana, a scale, things of that nature. At that point, the officer placed Mr. Pickering under arrest and handcuffed him. Once that was done, the officer walked over to the passenger side where Mr. Dank was standing. The officer noticed an eyeglass case lying near Mr. Dank's feet and asked if it belonged to Mr. Dank. Dank said that it did and placed the case on top of the car. The officer immediately opened the case and discovered drug paraphernalia inside.
Counsel, just on the facts, I just want clarification because I thought I heard you say something earlier with regard to the facts. The case was seen on the ground.
Correct.
What happened between, and what was said, if anything, between the time that the officer saw the case on the ground and it was on the hood of the car? What happened?
Your Honor, I believe that, as the state also pointed out in its brief, there were a couple different versions testified to at different hearings. So I'm going to do the best that I can to offer a cohesive version of the facts that I think are important. I think that what we can agree on, from my perspective, I think it's clear that the officer saw the case, asked Mr. Denk if it was his, and then either told him to put it on the car or either directed him to put it on the car or Mr. Denk reached down and put it on the car. I think that it's clear that the officer, I'm sorry.
Does it make any difference whether he picked it up voluntarily or whether he was directed to pick it up?
Under these circumstances, Your Honor, I don't believe that it does, because Mr. Pickering at this point was already under arrest. My client had seen the officer direct Pickering to put his objects on top of the car, so he knew that that's what he was supposed to do when he was directed to when he was asked about the case. It's certainly clear that the officer never asked Mr. Denk if he could look inside the case. And it's certainly clear that Mr. Denk never handed the case to the officer. So in my mind, under these facts, there was no clear consent, and so no, it doesn't matter.
Would you make any argument that this glasses case was not inside the vehicle at some point?
I think that that's a hard question because this is a Fourth Amendment issue, which is very fact specific, as we all know, and every fact matters. So if we speculate too much, that's just not the case before us. However, I think that it is possible that we don't know. The state never showed that, for example, Mr. Denk hadn't met Mr. Pickering at that spot, gotten into the car, and the case fell off of him before he ever got in the car. However, that is not pivotal to my argument because I believe that even if the case had been in the car at some point, the officer couldn't have searched it.
So if the case were in the passenger side floor of the car, do you believe officers under current case law could search it?
Probably yes. I'm hesitant to say that because those aren't facts of this case and the state didn't show how it got onto the ground, but I would say...
I'm just asking you to assume that this eyeglass case is in the passenger compartment on the floor. The officers could search it. True?
I would say probably yes.
And so what you're asking this court to do is create an increased level of protection once an item in a car is outside of a car.
Absolutely not, Your Honor. I don't believe that that's what I'm doing. I think that what's clear is that the officer could not have searched Mr. Denk's person, and we don't know how the eyeglass case got onto the ground. The state never showed how the eyeglass case got onto the ground. Just as we can speculate that it fell out of the floor of the car, it's just as reasonable to believe that it fell out of Mr. Denk's pocket or that he had tried to carry it out with him.
Well, the one thing we do know is it wasn't on his person.
And that it was not in the car.
So,
no, two things.
So, I can't get beyond the idea that you're asking for there to be an increased level of protection outside of a vehicle that there wouldn't be inside of a vehicle.
Let's look at it this way. I believe that it's clear that if Mr. Denk had a purse and had taken that outside the car with him, the officers could not have searched it. And so I don't really see the difference, a principal difference between a purse that he had carried or something in his pocket or something lying right at his feet that's not in the car anymore.
Your position is if he's in the car and he has his eyeglass case on his person, in his pocket, the police cannot search it.
Correct.
Can't search his person, can't touch him down and then take the glass case out and look at it if he's in the car. He gets out of the car, he has the glass case on his person, they can't search him for the glass case. Is that your position?
That's my position, Your Honor, except for that I would also add that again, it's very fact-specific.
Okay.
I'm not saying that the officer couldn't have asked Mr. Denk about the case.
We're not talking about that. We're talking about an involuntary search. All right. So now your position is if the glass case was in the car, it could be taken by the police. If it fell out of the car, it could be taken by the police. If it was on his person and fell off his person when he got out of the car, you think it can't be taken by the police. Is that your position?
Yes.
And it's up to the state, you say, to prove how the glass case got there, because the difference between whether it fell out of the car or it fell off his person is the cutting line for a federal constitutional search. How
yes.
can that all make sense? How can it make sense?
Well, because this,
because the other cases don't make sense either, right?
Aside from, I get that is part of the problem. Is yes, that the other cases don't make sense because there have been and the United States Supreme Court has recognized this too. There's been such an extension of the exception that it bears a very tenuous relationship to its initial justifications, and so we're stuck with these situations that don't fit in anywhere, and making strange distinctions that don't necessarily bear any relationship to the original justification because the exceptions that we're looking at don't.
But if the original justifications, I'm struck by your use of that phrase, our officer safety and the destruction of evanescent evidence. How are those two original justifications diminished by the fact that the eyeglass case happened to be found a few inches outside of the car when, if serendipitously or however, it had been found a few inches inside the car, in answer to in response to Justice Ziegler's question, the search would have been fine under well-established law. How are those original justifications diminished in this instance?
And again, I want to just point out, because my mind gets specific with these boxes, if we're talking about the search incident to arrest
yes.
exception.
As articulated in Schimmel, the two original justifications, officer safety and the diminishment of evanescent evidence.
Correct. And looking only at that exception is meant to protect officers from a dangerous arrest, from potentially dangerous behavior of an arrestee, somebody who's under arrest and has a reason to try to resist that arrest or to destroy evidence.
Wouldn't Mr. Pickering in this instance have had those motivations possibly?
Absolutely, and Your Honor, I believe that if the eyeglass case had been near Mr. Pickering's feet, absolutely the officers could have searched that.
So at his feet, what about 10 feet away?
Well, then I think we're in Schimmel territory because at this point, Belton doesn't really apply, so we have to go back to Schimmel and its original justifications and whether or not it's within his immediate reach and control.
So how many feet?
I think it depends on the facts, such as...
How about these facts? When you said, for instance, when you posited at Pickering's feet, that would be okay. How far away would it not be okay?
I would say, first of all, definitely not with a car in between Mr. Pickering and the case such that he couldn't reach it because there's a big object between Mr. Pickering and the case. And then beyond that, same case law that would define immediate control, the same sort of vague, nebulous officer decision about what would be his wingspan.
Which has been defined to include other rooms and apartment buildings.
Correct.
Well, he was handcuffed, wasn't he?
Yes.
Behind his back or in front?
I don't know. I'm sorry. I don't know. I can check.
I don't think you'll find it in the record, how he was handcuffed. Maybe you will. And the cases really don't turn on whether, as a practical, realistic matter, he could get that object.
No, they don't.
They don't. It's theoretically... He might. right?
That's correct. However, there have been limits placed on it by the United States Supreme Court. In Thornton, for example, they stressed that the arrestee had to be a recent occupant. In other words, if there's just too much attenuation spatially in terms of time between the arrestee and the object, no, it's not justified.
There wasn't here. It was limited space, limited time, right? And we're really looking at Pickering. That's not the defendant here.
Correct.
And Pickering wasn't under arrest, was he?
Pickering was under arrest.
Oh, he was being detained. Courts have said you can detain someone, you can put them in a squad car, you can put them in handcuffs, and that's not necessarily an arrest for custody. You might think you can't get away, but court says that's not an arrest. Didn't the officer testify that they arrested Pickering afterwards?
The officer testified that at the point that he had cuffed Mr. Pickering after finding these drugs on him, he considered him to be detained, yes.
Detained, not arrested. Go ahead. All right.
So you said something a few minutes ago about the spatial relationship between Pickering and the eyeglass case. We were having that colloquy. So do I properly infer that under your argument this presents an analysis under Chimmel as to whether the eyeglass case was within Pickering's area of immediate control?
I think that Schimmel is the most applicable test here.
Okay. And probably the crux of that matter was whether the item was within the immediate area of control of the one who was detained or arrested.
That's correct, and quite honestly, Your Honor, I don't remember all the permutations in terms of, I know sometimes it hasn't been allowed in other rooms or when the arrestee hasn't been in that spot, so I don't know all the permutations.
Well, I'm not trying to make a point. I'm not.
Oh.
I'm just trying to assist my understanding of your argument. And I think what you're arguing is, and I'm extrapolating from the at Pickering's feet versus the other side of the car, does this come down in your estimation to an issue of area of immediate control and how that is defined under the specific facts of this case?
Yes.
Okay.
Counsel?
Go ahead.
I've got a question that you started into several minutes ago, and that's the issue of consent. My understanding of the record is the circuit judge found consent in regard to the search of the glass case. Now, what does the record show? Was that the consent of Pickering? Was it the consent of Denk? And what was the judge basing that on, if you know?
I think that highlights a very distinct, unique factor in this case, which is that there really aren't any factual findings. However, searching the record, the trial court stated two things. The trial court stated that there was a consent to the search of the vehicle and that there was a consent to the search of the person of Mr. Denk. That second finding is clearly erroneous. There's nothing in the record that begins to indicate that Mr. Denk gave consent to the search of his person. And we know that Pickering can't give consent to Denk's person. The officer never, there's no testimony that the officer ever asked him if he could search his person or that there was any discussion about that at all. I think that's clearly erroneous. With regard to the consent of the search of the vehicle, again, I don't know what the trial court thought but I think what the most logical assumption is or the most logical interpretation is that the court was saying that because Mr. Pickering consented to the search of his vehicle, that included the eyeglass case. That's what I believe to be the most reasonable interpretation of what the trial court was trying to state. And I believe that while the court certainly was permitted to find that Mr. Pickering consented to the search of his vehicle because he did, that legally, as a matter of law, that did not justify the search of the eyeglass case. Wisconsin's case, State versus Mateka, and I don't know if I'm saying that right, in that case, the court said that if a driver slash owner of a car consents to the search of his car, that search would extend to passenger belongings left within the car.
Counsel, you got 5 minutes.
Okay, thank you.
Counsel?
Yes.
How do you see this case being written? If we write an opinion in your favor, what would the opinion say?
The opinion would say that this case doesn't fit into any of the exceptions to the warrant requirement. And
the exceptions of search incident to arrest, right?
Or probable cause.
Okay.
Or consent. Or reasonable suspicion. A pat down. And it was the state's burden to show how the eyeglass case got on the ground. And without a finding of fact about that, we can't.
Because it would be the state has to show how it got on the ground, because if it got on the ground this way, you're saying the state had no right to search it.
Correct.
In this way, as if it fell out of his pocket.
Or he tried to carry it with him and accidentally dropped it or dropped it. Yes. Yes. Anything other than it accidentally fell out of the car.
Could you amplify this point about reasonable suspicion?
Yes. I'll try. The other part that I think is important in this case is that if there had been something more, almost anything more, the officer could have searched the case.
Reasonable suspicion of whom? Dank or the driver?
Well, I believe, in terms of reasonable suspicion, I believe that if the officer had a reasonable suspicion that Mr. Dank, a reasonable and articulable suspicion that Mr. Dank was armed and dangerous, he could have patted him down, certainly. Whether or not that would have allowed him to open the eyeglass case, I can't answer. But what I do know is that if he had a reasonable, articulable suspicion that Mr. Dank was armed and dangerous, he could have cuffed Mr. Dank, he could have secured the eyeglass case. Same thing, if he had seen Mr. Dank make any sort of furtive movement, or if he had seen how the eyeglass case got onto the ground, these would be a completely different set of facts, and there would likely have been probable cause to search the case. He didn't ask Mr. Dank if he could search it. Certainly he could have done that. He could have searched the car. If he had searched the car and found some linkage between Mr. Dank and contraband, then he would have probably had probable cause as to Mr. Dank and could have searched his eyeglass case. There were lots of different things that could have happened, but that didn't happen in this case. All we know is that there's an eyeglass case on the ground next to Mr. Dank's feet, and that there's no particularized suspicion as to Jordan Dank that would allow the officer to have probable cause to search that case, and that it was not within the immediate control of Mr. Pickering such that a search incident to arrest would allow the search of that case. And it was the state's burden, and in this particular case.
Was there probable cause that case was inside the car?
I believe that there was certainly a reason to believe that the case had been inside the car, but I don't believe that ends the inquiry, Your Honor, because I believe that in order to open the case, what the officer needs is a particularized suspicion that case contains contraband. The officer needs probable cause as to the eyeglass case, as to Mr. Dank. Some linkage between Mr. Dank and or the eyeglass case and contraband. And I don't believe that whether or not the case was in the car is enough in and of itself to provide that kind of probable cause that would allow a search of the eyeglass case.
Well, let me Why don't you shoot down this theory? The driver gave consent to search the car, and searching the car could have reached a glasses case if it were in the car. There was probable cause to search the car based on the odor and a whole number of other factors. And you could have reached the eyeglass case if it was in the car. And after the driver was arrested, there was cause, there was justification to search the car incident to the arrest, and that would have included the passengers, containers within that. I think the question is, are you going to require the state to pinpoint how something that in all probability was in the car, how it got outside the car? Because if you say that if it was deliberately put out of the car, you can search it. If it fell out of the car, you can search it. But if it fell off of the person, you can't search it. It seems to me any intelligent criminal, might be an oxymoron, but if any intelligent criminal would say, I wasn't trying to abandon that. It wasn't just laying around in the car. That fell out of my pocket.
And, Your Honor, I believe that, is it all right if I answer
you
this?
You may answer that, Counsel.
I believe that that the eyeglass case could not have been searched if it was on Mr. Dank's person or if he had taken it out. So why wouldn't he have just put it in his pocket? Also, if he was trying to abandon the eyeglass case, there would be different facts. Those aren't the facts here. It would have likely been further for him, or he would have disclaimed any ownership of it. And so, given these facts, and I just have to stress that, given these facts and the fact that it's the state's burden to prove an exception to the warrant requirement, and there are no actual facts proven to support that, the state hasn't met its burden.
Thank you, Counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Rossi, Assistant Attorney General Rossi, representing the state of Wisconsin.
Thank you, Chief Justice. If I might add, I'm honored to be here. This is my first appearance before this court, although there's been over 100, maybe hundreds, in this courtroom when I was an assistant DA appearing before Judge Carver trying to teach me how to do my job.
Counselor, would you lift up the microphone?
Yes.
You're tall, so you don't fit with the short group. Thank you very much.
Subject to answering the court's questions, there's 3 points I'd like to touch upon just to at least list before getting into my prepared remarks. First of all, I presume the court's aware that Arizona v. Gant is being argued before the United States Supreme Court today as we speak, I think, and it's touching upon a very similar issue, whether police need to actually show a threat to safety and risk of destruction of evidence upon arresting someone who's already left the car before they do a search incident to arrest. The Court of Appeals asked us to file supplemental briefs as to whether Brusky, the standing case that this court decided, had any bearing on it. Of course, we'd be happy to file any supplemental briefs this court might require if it deems that this Gant case is important to deciding this case. The second issue is that in response to the odor of marijuana cases that the appellant has listed in his reply brief, in the course of rebutting them, I would also make the argument that those cases demonstrate that the police officer had probable cause to arrest Mr. Dank right from the get-go, and that this court need not go through our argument as to an extension of search incident to arrest interior of the car or probable cause extension, probable cause to search a car if it accepts that argument.
Your position is if you have five people in the car, you smell marijuana, you have probable cause to arrest all five of them?
Within limits, Chief Justice.
Oh, okay, four people in the car. Three people in the car.
Belton, I think, had four.
Okay. So four, can we settle on four? How many in the car, in this car?
Two.
Two, all right. So if you have two people in the car, you smell marijuana, then you have probable cause to arrest both of them.
Under Mitchell, under Belton, although admitting that Sechrist and Mata indicate that there has to be linkage, in Mitchell, 1992, this court, Belton, 1981, it was an aside. The issue there is search of the car incident to arrest, and they found cocaine. What he actually arrested him for, all four people in the car upon odor of marijuana. And most importantly, one of the cases mentioned in Appellant Denk's reply brief is U.S. v. Humphreys, Fourth Circuit. That case relies heavily upon Pringle versus Maryland, Maryland versus Pringle, 2003. In Maryland versus Pringle, the officer arrested the driver and two occupants, all three people, upon finding cocaine hidden in the back seat, and Mr. Pringle was in the front seat. And the court reasoned that you could arrest all three, either because if it only had to be one out of the three, probable cause to arrest does not require that you exclude all possibilities. It does not require that guilt be more probable than not, and or it could have been a joint venture. So the court upheld the arrest of all three upon finding cocaine in the back seat, Mr. Pringle being the farthest away from the cocaine.
So your theory is that you smell marijuana, there are two people in the car, you don't have to say which one was smoking it, which one had it. You have probable cause to arrest both. The officer arrests neither and does a search of the glass case, whether it's on Mr. Denk or on the ground, doesn't make any difference. Is that your position?
Correct, Chief Justice. Also, under Sykes and Rawlings versus Kentucky, it doesn't matter if the search comes before the arrest or if the officer actually arrests for the fruits of the search. What matters is that there is probable cause to arrest independent of the search that exists before the search and that the officer is aware of those facts. The officer's intention or how he might muck up the theories doesn't matter. In this instance, there was that.
He
had
probable
cause.
Was there?
Pardon?
Was there an arrest of either of these people before they looked at the glass case?
There was not.
There was no arrest.
Yes, I believe you're correct.
It was close enough in time.
Exactly. Under Sykes and Rawlings, there was no problem. You were correct that the driver, Mr. Pickering, was simply detained.
Counsel, you have a lot of arguments in the brief and now. What's your best? Is it this one that you just gave? Is that your best, or is it the incident to arrest, or is it the consent, or is it the extension of probable cause?
Justice Bradley, I'd say the best argument is the one I started with, search incident to arrest. Although I would now put into second place that they had probable cause to arrest Mr. Denk right off the bat because of the smell of marijuana.
Hey, let me ask, the search incident to an arrest, excuse me, that arguably requires an extension here, inside versus outside, arguably.
Yes, it does.
Your close second doesn't seem to require an extension of the law at all. Am I correct or incorrect in the same?
You are correct, and thus I would revise my earlier answer and put them both as number one, I'm afraid. I did not pursue that in the brief, the odor of marijuana, because the police officer didn't say that, the prosecutor didn't say that, and the judge didn't say that. And now perhaps I should have. I didn't think as seriously about those cases as perhaps I should have until I read them in Mr. Denk's reply brief.
Well, maybe it should go back for factual findings. We have a little problem in this, don't we, that a lot of findings were not made.
I agree, Chief Justice. The judge's ruling caused me to sit and think a lot of how I would phrase it. However, as the Court of Appeals indicated, the facts aren't in genuine dispute. So I don't think there needs to be a remand for findings of fact.
Counsel, isn't the determination about probable cause one objective and independent of the subjective opinion of the officer?
That is correct, Justice.
And so therefore, would there be a need in your opinion to remand this for further findings of fact about what the officer thought? We know that the odor of marijuana, according to the unrebutted testimony, was emanating from the motor vehicle, and we know that Denk was a passenger in that motor vehicle.
I do not believe it would be necessary to remand because there wouldn't have to be factual findings. It's whether this court adopts the theory advanced by the judge, which I admit was somewhat problematic. Well, search incident into arrest wasn't problematic. The judge's theory that Mr.
Denk... I didn't make myself clear enough. The odor of marijuana, your second strong argument, now your first argument.
Correct.
We scrutinize whether probable cause existed under a reasonable officer standard, whether a reasonable officer in the same or similar circumstances would have had sufficient probable cause. Is that your understanding?
That this court reviews that ultimate question de novo, yes it is, Justice. Okay.
And so, really, the subjective thought of the officer at the time, for the purposes of our review, doesn't matter.
That's correct. And there is as much testimony as one is ever going to get as to his smelling marijuana and that it was inordinately strong. That leads to the third point that I had wanted to raise. The Court of Appeals certification questions, the state respectfully asserts that the Court of Appeals is going down the wrong path on that and that there is no burden on the state to prove how the glass case got on the ground. It's simply that it was found on the ground, and that's all that counts. First of all, what I'm saying, I believe, is consistent with the law, and secondly, it would potentially impose an impossible burden on the state. Normally, a party has a burden of proof only if they have the chance to prove it or who is in the best position, for example, affirmative defenses. In this instance, in many instances, it would be virtually impossible, and in our view, it's wholly irrelevant. If this case had been found in the car, the state would not have to prove if it had ever been on Mr. Denk's person. It makes no difference if it's found on the ground. It's just the issue is car ground. Point of origin doesn't matter at all. And it further doesn't matter if the case were found in the car. The state would not have to prove that Mr. Denk deliberately took it out rather than that it's an accidental falling out. It's totally irrelevant. The fact is that it was in the car, subject to search. So again, I would say that in this case, what counts is that it's on the ground. And that's where the officer finds it. Where it was before that doesn't matter too much, although that is... At one point in time, if ever, it was on his person in a pocket. The state does assert that the only reasonable inference from this record is that it was in the car until he exited it. The record does indicate that they said they were driving along. Denk is a visitor. He stays in that county once in a while. And that they stopped to make a call because of better cell phone reception. There is no indication that they came together only then and there. I would say it's indisputable. The case had been in the car up until moments before the officer came upon it. And if one under search and seizure law is required to split hairs, then I would also point out that, yes, it's true. The officer told him to pick it up, but he didn't tell him what to do with it. Mr. Denk did not put it in his pocket. He didn't put it back in the car. He put it on top of the car, giving himself even greater access to it. And perhaps this is too hyper-technical, but arguably one could make a distinction between a foot away from the car and sitting on top of it and touching it. That is a hyper-distinction, but sometimes it seems that Fourth Amendment law requires that sort of thing.
Counsel, in your brief, you rely very heavily on State v. Poloni.
Correct.
Now, it seems to me you've changed your argument a bit, an oral argument, which is fine. Do you still rely on Poloni with your two new issues?
Yes, Chief Justice, because Poloni is the primary case we're relying upon to show that it was justified by as a search incident to arrest. And we're asking this court to extend the concept of search incident to arrest to items like the gas case that had been, until moments before seen, in the car and subject to search.
You keep saying in the car. In the car loose or in the car on his person, or doesn't it matter to you?
It doesn't matter.
Okay. Mattered to the defense. Added to the Court of Appeals in its certification.
That is correct, Chief Justice. I just think that is going down the wrong path. What counts here is that when the officer saw it, it was on the ground, and Denk, told to pick it up, admittedly, voluntarily put it on the car, even closer to himself.
What do you think this case will teach teach police officers and law enforcement in the future? I mean, this is one of the issues, right? We want officers to adhere to the Fourth Amendment, right? We all take an oath to...
Yes.
...to support the Constitution. Police officers do, this court does, you do too. So what about this case is going to tell all of us, tell the officer, tell the trial court, tell the Court of Appeals, and tell us for future cases, is appropriate under the Fourth Amendment?
If, as we argue, this court finds that this extension of Poloni and Houghton, by the way, for the vehicle probable cause exception, is perfectly consistent with the evolution of search incident to arrest law from Schimmel 69 up through the present, my answer is, granting the extension that we request, if this court does not want to resolve it on the odor of marijuana issue, is consistent with the development of Fourth Amendment law, because now searches incident to arrest of a car aren't strictly limited to inside the passenger compartment, but it's still wholly consistent with search incident to arrest generally, even in houses where there's a greater expectation of privacy, which is within access and control.
So it's going to say, if you have probable cause to arrest A in the car, Mr. A, and there is a Mr. B in the car, you can search anything outside of Mr. B's person if it's within the area that Mr. A could get control of and therefore have a weapon or could destroy evidence. Is that what this case will say?
With the proviso that it had been in the passenger compartment, I would say yes.
But you said it wasn't important whether it was in the passenger or if it was on his person. What was important was that it was on the ground. I'm sorry if I misunderstood you. It's not in the passenger compartment. It's on the ground now.
That's correct. My point is, whether the Chief Justice finds it convincing or not, is that even if it was on Denk's person, it was in the car. That's my point.
Okay. Well, now that's why I'm pressing you on this. So your position is, if there's probable cause to arrest Mr. A, you can search Mr. B, on his person or objects outside of his person, in order to find a weapon that might harm the officer or evidence that might be confiscated by Mr. A, whom you've arrested. Is that the point?
We are not.
If I'm not telling it right, you tell me what the rule is that you want.
We are not asking the court to make a finding.
I'm not making a finding. There's a rule of law.
Okay, a rule of law that search incident to arrest would now justify items found in a pocket of an occupant.
On the person, okay.
Correct.
You're not asking that.
We're simply asking the court make a rule of law that would say if the item had been in the passenger compartment and is found contemporaneously or almost instantaneously a few inches outside of it, that it is included because the initial concerns for officer safety, destruction evidence are still present.
So you mean if it's in the passenger compartment, on the person or not on the person, you can search it?
No.
If it's now loose from the person.
If it's now loose from the person, yes.
Okay.
And yes,
that makes the Court of Appeals certification question irrelevant.
As to our burden of proof to prove how it got on the ground, it does.
Okay.
And
that's
my point.
That's what I'm trying to find out.
I'm sorry it took me so long.
No, no. It's a hard concept of when this all moves around.
And all of the court's questions are very probative. It also makes me think that the odor of marijuana would have been a much easier way for the officer to resolve this.
Let me stay with that odor of marijuana.
Right.
I'm going to see if I can knock it back to second. I'm just teasing.
Okay.
what about Sechrist, the Sechrist case, and the linkage? I mean, just odor of marijuana. And there's other cases, too. How do you tie that loop?
Justice Bradley, I jump over it. Okay.
When in danger or in doubt, just avoid it.
I would say this, that Mitchell, 1992, and Pringle, 2003, stand for the proposition that two or three, maybe four, because there were four in Belton, occupants in a car, odor of marijuana, the linkage is met. That's my position. I wanted to make sure that certain facts that I think are critical
I'm sorry, but I just looked at the dates now. Mitchell, you can't say based on Mitchell, can you? Because Sechrist is 1999, Mitchell is 1992. In other words, I understood you to be saying, well, Mitchell supersedes Sechrist, but it doesn't. It's quite the contrary. Mitchell is 92, I think.
That's correct.
And Sechrist is 99.
I'm almost positive Sechrist did not in any respect cut back on or attempt to overrule Mitchell. And then it was, I think, a couple months later in Mata that the Court of Appeals tried to reconcile the two, mm-hmm. acting as if Mitchell is still good law, okay. and trying to put the two together.
Thank you.
And then, of course, we have Pringle, which I think puts us miles ahead on that one.
What did Pringle say?
Pringle was the case, three occupants of a car, officer searches, finds cocaine in the back seat. The court said it's fine to arrest all three for possession of cocaine. There was joint dominion and control, sorted out at trial. Maybe it was a joint enterprise. And again, I emphasize, in Belton, four people in the car arrested on the odor of marijuana. The case hinges then on the search incident to arrest where they found cocaine.
Pringle was in what court?
United States Supreme Court, I'm sorry.
These cases are not cited in the brief.
It's a little unsettling to me. In all honesty, I think you got a pretty good case. There's so many theories that you can. The question is just perfecting a theory so it makes sense and doesn't do damage to the law. But it is a little unsettling to me when the theories keep coming that haven't been briefed. I was looking for State versus Sechrist in your brief because I wrote the case and I thought it was perfectly applicable. It wasn't in here. And now you're talking about Mitchell and Pringle and other cases here.
You're correct. The only thing I can say is that they were cited Sechrist, Mata, Wilson, Humphreys, Gibson were cited in Mr. Denk's reply brief. In retrospect, I agree, and I'm sorry I wasn't alert enough to raise this theory earlier, but at least technically they're in the record because Mr. Denk has raised them, and Pringle is the case upon which Humphreys relies. Right, Mr. Denk did not cite Pringle. He cites Humphreys, which relies on it. Yeah, the court's point is well taken.
Except for the fact. I'm sorry, go ahead.
It seems to me the reason I thought of the Sechrist case, simply the moment that overpowering odor of burning marijuana was detected emanating from the vehicle, there was probable cause to search the vehicle right then and there. But it seemed to me we were wrestling in that case, once you get the ability to search vehicle, do you also get to arrest each and every person in that vehicle? How do you link the persons in the vehicle to the odor and the evidence that's probably in that space?
If memory serves, first of all, I think Sechrist was a sole occupant, and then the court talked about necessary linkage. The two responses I can make to that. I'm not understanding Mitchell to have been overruled. And in Mitchell, it was two occupants in a vehicle, both arrested, although admittedly it was both the odor of marijuana and the sight of smoke. Mata discusses that. Is smoke important? There was both in Mitchell. Then there is Pringle, which doesn't deal with odor, but it deals with three people, and you don't have anything particular for any of them. The guy in the back seat is closest, but it didn't matter to the court.
You're right, counsel, that the reply brief does, on pages 5 and 6, refer to Sechrist, Mata, and Wilson, but takes the position of linkage.
That's correct. Facts which I think I need to highlight, although I'm sure the court is aware of them, having read the briefs, is that there is more going on in this than one might think. I know counsel for Mr. Denk wasn't pretending that this was all the facts or all that was happening. It's what she thought that was important. But the driver had a knife. Only a Swiss Army knife, but a knife is a knife. The cop was out 11 p.m. On a dark country road alone. These two men are smoking marijuana, and a reasonable inference is that they're stoned, and that upsets judgment, puts the cop in a little more dangerous situation. The driver, Mr. Pickering, after producing the knife and some cigarettes and papers, wouldn't produce anything else. He wouldn't allow the officer to pat him down. He clenched his fists, and the officer described it as it looked like he's gearing up to fight or run. It was at that point the officer cuffed him and then emptied his sweatshirt and found drugs, for which he was later arrested. Mr. Denk had already volunteered when the officer asked, "Why do I smell marijuana coming out of your car?" that he had not smoked marijuana since May when he was released from drug rehab. All of this together makes this situation a bit more ominous than one might ordinarily think. Also, in the, getting back here to extension of the search incident to arrest if the officer finds the glass case on the ground, Frye stands for the proposition that it's almost as a matter of law, even if the defendant is cuffed in a squad car under guard, there still is, by the fact of arrest, risk to the officer, and therefore they can search the car. And in Frye, they went into a locked glove compartment to pull out his gun when he's cuffed and in a squad with another officer. In this case, the driver is standing behind his own car. He is cuffed, but he's there. He's not in a squad. There's nobody else guarding him. And there is some legitimate concern about Mr. Denk himself. What's he going to do? I think the officer did not ever attempt to justify looking in the case as any kind of Terry frisk. That wasn't argued.
At what?
Terry frisk. I'm sorry, I'm not standing close enough to the mic. But putting that aside, I don't want to introduce yet another theory into this. The fact remains that this was a bit of an ominous situation, and therefore we believe that extending search incident to arrest doctrine to include something that a few moments before was inside the passenger compartment is quite reasonable, because there is a real risk here far above and beyond the risk as a matter of law that Frye describes. And also, it's a certain irony that there was the active destruction of evidence. They were smoking it. A little more concern than one might otherwise have if it's just pills or marijuana in a baggie.
Could they have arrested for driving while intoxicated or driving while drugged? Is that a reasonable inference? They smell marijuana?
I have truly never thought about that, Chief Justice. I don't know. He wasn't. He was arrested for the marijuana on his person.
Because you said the inference was he stoned. That's what made me think.
That is my word. But he said the officer did testify that the smell of marijuana was just overwhelming when he went back a second time, got close, and they actually opened the window.
Could I ask, what exactly is the defendant attempting to suppress?
A pipe used for smoking methamphetamine that was in a hard black glasses case.
Only something found in a hard black case?
That is the focus of the suppression motion, the actual drugs found on his person. There were two more pipes found in his jacket, a bag of marijuana and a bag of methamphetamine found in some other pocket, I presume a shirt. He wanted all those suppressed as fruits of the poisonous tree.
Okay, but the poisonous tree didn't extend to the search of something in the vehicle. Because of all of these things, I mean, evidence found in the vehicle wouldn't be suppressed, would it?
Quite so. It was the defense theory that the glasses case wasn't in the vehicle. And that's the turning point.
Well, the pipes were in the jacket, not in the vehicle that he wants suppressed, right?
Two of the pipes were in the jacket.
Right.
The critical pipe was in the glasses case,
right,
on
okay.
the ground.
And the drugs were in his pockets. So we're not talking about any. Does he want to suppress anything in the vehicle?
Anything loose in the vehicle? No, Chief Justice.
He does not. Because he says that goes to the other guy. That. All the stuff in the vehicle is not brought up against
not
him.
Not in his jacket, though.
No. The jacket he wants suppressed. The drugs in the jacket he wants suppressed.
Mr. Denk does, yes.
Was the jacket in the vehicle?
The jacket with the pipes was in the vehicle.
Okay, thank you.
Officer went back to it after Mr. Denk's arrested and put in the squad. I see my red lights on.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Lucy.
You.
I'm going to start with some factual disputes. Apparently the facts aren't undisputed, as the Court of Appeals said. It is not in the record that the jacket was found in the car. That's my understanding of the record.
Okay.
And in fact, in terms of the drugs that were found, I know the state has asserted that both the methamphetamine, which there was residue on a small gem baggie, it wasn't a rock of methamphetamine found. It was residue on a baggie. And I know that the state asserted that that was found on his person. However, the officer also testified at the suppression hearing that that was found in the glasses case. So there is some confusion as to the facts. I don't think that that matters, but I think that it's not fair to say that the drugs were found in his pocket. But it's certainly not fair to say that the jacket was found in the car. That's not what the officer ever testified to. I also just want to talk a little bit about Pringle and the state's take on Pringle. I cited Pringle because Pringle clearly says that a linkage is required. What the state hasn't mentioned is that in Pringle, a very crucial factor was that the officer said to people, "Is that yours?" And everyone said, "Nope, nope, nope, nope." So there was no linkage between anybody and the drugs that were found in the car. They still required a linkage. Or a lack of linkage, a linkage between the defendant and the drugs. In this case, there were no drugs found on Mr. Denk's person or within his control. The drugs, at the time that the officer searched that eyeglass case, the only drugs or contraband that the officer had found were clearly in Mr. Pickering's front pocket, not on the seat of the car where Mr. Denk also had equal access to the drugs. So I think it's clear that...
Ms. Cerrone, doesn't it seem to you that Mr. Lossie concluded his portion of argument by really making an argument for the extension of the bright line test articulated and announced in Belton, which allows for the search of the passenger compartment of the motor vehicle and the containers therein sufficient to hold the weapon or the contraband? And it seems to me that his last argument was for an extension of the bright line Belton rule to cover what appears to me from the record a few inches outside of the motor vehicle of an item we know, the record it seems very clear, that we know the item had been in the motor vehicle. He's asking for an extension of Belton to include a few inches outside of the motor vehicle. Does it seem to you that that's his argument as well?
I do believe that is a primary argument that the state made, yes, Your Honor.
Then I guess, given, and this brings us, you and I, full circle, isn't that interesting? We started talking about this at the beginning of this hearing. What's so unreasonable about that?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, I want to reiterate that a couple of points, and I'm not sure if I made them the first time around. First of all, the United States Supreme Court has never held that Belton applies to passenger belongings. Never. So that in and of itself is an extension. Houghton was a probable cause case.
Doesn't it say any container contained within the passenger compartment sufficient to contain the suspect material?
No, that's probable cause. And what the United States Supreme Court said in Wyoming versus Houghton was specifically, we're not deciding this on the search incident to arrest exception, which is justified by officer safety and destruction of evidence. We are justifying this on the probable cause exception, which is any item in the passenger compartment capable of concealing the search. So already to say that, and there were qualifications, it was a plurality decision, but it certainly didn't go to the search incident to arrest exception. It didn't extend it that far. Also, the problem with the bright line rules is they start out making sense and tied to the justification, like Schimmel did, like Belton did. And I know Scalia criticized in Thornton. Can I finish?
Yes, you may. Finish your sentence, please.
Scalia and Thornton criticized how far we've taken it and stretched it, so it bears no reasonable relationship to its original justifications. And search incident to arrest, simple bright line rule, can search within a car. Again, it's never been extended to passenger belongings, and it's certainly never been extended to items outside of the car that are identified as the passengers. And to do so, I believe, would violate the Fourth Amendment.
Thank you, counsel. I think this is this your first time arguing here too, Ms. Cerrone? Second. Well, we have
I was on the road in Hudson last year.
Oh, is that right? I guess we take you on the road with us from now on. Well, we appreciate both your arguments this morning, and we will take this case under advisement. And that ends the hearing on 06-AP-1744-CR, State versus Dank. And for those in the audience, you can read.